Fire Engineering Podcasts are sponsored by MSA. Firefighters want to be connected to each other, to dispatch, and to their commanders. MSA has created Lunar, a wireless, handheld device that includes thermal imaging, firefighter ranging, motion alarm, and cloud technology with GPS. It's part of the new connected firefighter platform from MSA. Learn more at msafire.com.
Welcome to today's Fire Engineering Hangout. We have a great show for you today, and I want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas and a Happy Hanukkah. We have Greg Markley here, who's running for General Secretary Treasurer of the IFF. I think it's really important that we listen to what he has to say today, and we're real excited that he came on. Not all the candidates came on. Jake Lamone came on, and now Greg has come on, and we really appreciate it. And I think it means a lot to the members of the IFF that individuals aren't afraid to step out in an area that might be a little bit less than comfortable from a union meeting type of setting or a union hall that we're used to. But our members have a right to know what's going on with their money. For my monologue, sound public fiscal reporting is indispensable for maintaining confidence in our institutions of organized labor. It breeds transparency, which safeguards integrity and accountability of elected union leaders who owe that to their members. Those members have a right to know how their hard-earned money is being spent. What's more, union members and taxpayers share a bona fide interest in discouraging civil and criminal violations. In the end, after all, union members are often directly impacted by such violations, and the taxpayers, and as firefighters, we're all taxpayers as well, we burden the high cost of court proceedings required to prosecute those who abuse the members' trust. Every year, union workers somewhere in this country receive a sheepish email with a demoralizing announcement that there's been a financial scandal amongst their leadership. The U.S. Department of Labor tracks hundreds of these cases each year. The DOL recorded over 123 enforcement actions this year alone out of 80 individual cases. This number is astounding and represents charges ranging from wire fraud, falsification of union records, money laundering, and embezzlement. But one thing that I was really surprised of, when I looked at the Department of Labor statistics, I thought that we would have some issues with vendors. However, 75% of the crimes committed against our members, the individual had the title of president or treasurer. The other thing that was majorly disturbing to me is that the Department of Labor also doesn't track when things are settled in-house outside of public scrutiny, where the person just resigns, chooses not to run again, or just simply pays back the money that was taken. I want to read just a quick paragraph from a public submission from Brian Skyeagle, who's a lawyer, and I also want to congratulate him. He just made deputy chief in the Houston Fire Department, but he was a union president. So the issues that we see in Connecticut with what I consider just plain abuse that's been backed up by the courts, I was amazed to see this is going on in Texas too. And he writes, and again, he's a lawyer, and this wasn't just some email. This was a public submission to the Department of Labor testimony. The guy just banged on the door. As a past president of a local union in a very large city, we're talking about Houston, I could speak directly to extreme financial abuses that go unrestrained by lack of labor department laws and enforcement. In my experience, discovering crushing financial mismanagement and outright fraud sparked a year-long battle with the International and the Board of Directors. This ensuing war for financial information turned into a war to demonize the witness, the whistleblower, for calling for financial transparency. That is why the Department of Labor proposed reform on LM2s is important. Local auditing efforts prove to be worthless when the only information given to the accountant is grossly inadequate or outright falsified. This is the experience that I found too, is that Often treasurers will refer to our documents are audited. It's a way to defer scrutiny from the members. But I was wrong. I used to think auditing was the cure-all. When somebody said, oh, our books are audited, I thought that would be great. I was wrong. Auditing is like a computer. You got to put the right information in to get the right information out. And that's why it comes down to the integrity of the individual. I've had an opportunity to speak with Greg. He has none of our questions for today. And I know some of the same people that he knows, and I've heard nothing but good things, and that he is a man of integrity. So we really appreciate him coming on today. And the last thing for my monologue is, reform can't be just a word, you know, action is needed. PJ, if you could introduce our guest today.
As many of our followers and listeners know, that we normally don't go through the entire bio of our guests. Usually their words and their actions and what they share with us during these shows is usually enough. However, today I'm going to share a lot of Greg's bio because he's running for the General Secretary Treasurer position. And if you pay attention to some of the stuff in his bio that I'm going to discuss briefly, helps highlight his experience going into this election. So Greg's been an IFF member for 36 years. He served as a secretary and treasurer of the Washington State Council of Firefighters for the past 17 plus years. He's been on the board since 1997. Washington State Council of Firefighters represents 124 local firefighters and paramedic unions and 8,900 active members across the state of Washington. A few other things that Greg is involved in, things that he has his hands in. He chairs the Washington State Council of Firefighters Post-Retirement Medical Expense Reimbursement Plan, which serves over 8,000 professional firefighters and paramedics. He chairs the organization's Northwest Firefighters Benefit Trust with over 3,000 members and their families across six states. He's a trustee for the Washington State Investment Board. He's a chair of the Public Markets Committee, overseeing $140 billion in public employee retirement assets. On top of that, he's actually still a division chief for Puget Sound Regional Authority south of Seattle, where he oversees community governmental relations, accreditation, and grant management. On top of that, he has a degree in Bachelor of Science in Accounting and deep experience in finance. So Greg, while we normally don't go into those details, I felt that it was important for us to share more of your bio than what we would normally. So our listeners today and those watching this either live, we have somebody that logged in, a couple people logged in, we're up to almost 100 live listeners right now, understand your experience on top of what you're going to tell us about your campaign. So as Frank said, we really appreciate you coming to us today and sharing your thoughts and your opinions for our listeners. So welcome.
Yeah, thank you, PJ. Thanks for that introduction. And thanks to you, Frank, and Peter's in the background doing the work to make everything happen, which is kind of behind the curtains here. It's certainly my pleasure to be on with you today. And other than that bio that you just read, Peter, you know, I think firefighters particularly want to know where we're from. So Puget Sound Fire, which is just south of Seattle, about 20 minutes. We have 290 firefighters and 13 stations. So if you've ever been up here to the Pacific Northwest, around Seattle Tacoma International Airport, we pretty much protect the area around the airport. But all in all, we're about 110 square miles. And to give you a little perspective, when I hired on our fire department, I was the 44th person hired. So you can imagine in the 80s and 90s when suburbias blew up, we had organic growth, certainly. But through mergers and consolidations, that's how we are up to 13 stations and 290 firefighters. And we actually have nurses in our union. So with the Community Paramedic Act that we had and that provision within legislation at the federal government, low acuity calls, we've created what we call a CARES program. And we have nurses responding with firefighters on low acuity calls 24/7. And that's one of the first in the nation. And they're actually in our union now. So we're very proud of that. So rather than, I guess I'll just stop right there. And certainly any questions that you guys have, let's just get into it.
PJ, I'll let you start.
Okay. So Greg, one of those uncomfortable questions, and this should be no surprise to you, but the IAFF Fill the Boot campaign raised about $20 million in both 2018 and 2019. right? Firefighters across this country do amazing work for an amazing organization of the MDA. But something that's recently come to light is that the MDA has donated back to the IFF between $980,000 to $1.4 million every year since 2015. And some of the information indicates that additional large donations track all the way back to 2008. Many IFF members that Frank and I have spoken with are very concerned over this. The IFF says that this money is for administrative costs. Now, we completely understand that there are absolutely some administrative costs associated. But I know my local and other locals here in Connecticut, we receive no real support from the IFF during our Fill the Boot campaign. All the public, the marketing materials, the stickers, the banners, all of that comes from the MDA, not from the IFF. So what's your opinion and your stance on these large donations coming from the MDA, where we want to see, me personally, I want to see every dollar that I raise in the Fill the Boot campaign go directly to the MDA and stay with the MDA?
Yeah, I guess three words, wrong, wrong, wrong. And let me give you a little background on this. I don't know if you guys are even familiar with this. Going back two conventions now, there was a local president here in Washington State that brought a resolution forward to convention to stop this very thing. And in the fact that MDA was basically kicking back money to the international. We all thought it was wrong. We were like, you got to be kidding me. That's ridiculous. And so we brought that resolution, and I certainly helped this individual, this president, and that resolution actually made it to the floor. But I want to tell you what happened in the background here, which was very disheartening. Basically, through members of the international, the board, and Harold in this instance, some things I agree with Harold Schaeberger on, the president, GP, some I don't. No respect to Harold if I use his first name. I've just known him for a long time. They refused to even read the committee's work when the resolution came forward. And it was almost like a smear campaign for the individual who brought it forward. And in fact, they had a letter from the CEO of MDA saying that it was a valuable partnership. We should continue with this. We have no problem giving the money. And basically, we were just crushed on the floor at convention, right? And before it actually reached the floor in convention, because it was a contentious issue, it went to some committee work first. I actually met with Harold Schaeberger and his staff outside of convention at a break in a meeting room to try to resolve this thing about how this isn't right. Okay, this president, he'll back off if we get some type of reform, if we somehow have an opportunity to move away from our reliance on MDA, and they weren't going to budge. So I really think it's wrong. And I really look at it this way. And I think that number last year was $1.3 million. So you can imagine all of us that do Fill the Boot around the country. And let's say we had 20 locals that raised $50,000. If they heard that their $50,000 was going to the international, they'd go crazy, right? Absolutely crazy, and rightfully so. So we have to reduce our reliance on that money. Now, that's a per capita impact that's rolled into the budget as far as what we're using for per capita dollars. We do have a position. So we've created a position within the IFF budget, but it's only around 50 grand. That we've created this position, this liaison between MDA and the IAFF as an actual employee. And, I think we have to definitely, we're all in this. We don't go around and raise money at our local charities and expect to, any type of kickback related to that. We don't go helping our local community baseball organizations and then expect some type of recognition or a kickback. That's what we do. So I think that that really has to change. And certainly if I get into office, I'm going to make every effort to stop that reliance on that money. Although remember, that $1.4 million, that's a per capita implication, or we have to look at something else in the budget that we wouldn't do.
Greg, I want to compliment you on such a cogent answer. And the fact is, you're not ever used to hearing a politician. And I was a union president for a long time, so if you're in a union leadership, you're a little bit of a politician, and your answer of it being wrong, wrong, wrong was a real answer. And what I'm really heartened about that kind of shows a little bit behind the scenes is that you had a role in saying this was wrong from the beginning. All too often people go to the convention and they don't really participate in the convention, or if they do participate in it, when they come back, the membership doesn't get all of the information. So I always like to quote John Mayer, the philosopher of modern time. You know, if you own the information, you can bend it all you want. And the fact that you were there fighting for this from the get-go is critical. My next question for you is, there's been a lot of criticism of Eddie Kelly for essentially going to the outside to raise some red flags. However, absent of a whistleblower policy that the IFF hopefully will adopt one day, absent of that, if Eddie Kelly didn't go to the outside, I think that you can fool the spectators, you can't fool the players. I think everybody knows who's a union member that we wouldn't know really what was going on in the IFF. Are you for a whistleblower policy to protect somebody who says, hold on a second, we need to take a hard look at this?
Yeah, I don't know, whistleblower policy. I agree with you. Now, I was a critic of Ed for what he did and the way he did it, but we only have a limited amount of the information. The more I talk to Ed Kelly, the more I agree with what he had to do. In fact, and it really speaks to the dysfunction at the International between our two principal officers. You had two guys there that didn't even talk to each other in the last couple of years. And you had Harold Schaefer. There's no doubt he had a strong hold on this organization and that board for a very long time. And, you know, you can talk to Ed about the specifics related to exactly what happened there. And, you know, particularly related, there were two issues. One, about the applicability of a pension that Harold received, and two, about some of these expenses and whether they were authorized or missing money. And that was the problem when we were watching all of this afar as IFF members, and it really blowing up in the media and blowing up in newsprint related to articles. I was, as a 36-year member, I was ticked off, man. I was pissed off. Like, what the hell's going on? Let's blow the whole thing up, right? And I couldn't understand why it was playing out that way. And I had a long discussion with Ed. First, I started with, hey, I'm disappointed in what happened and how this happened. I certainly don't have all of the information. And then he then explained, and the more you talk to Ed, the more information you get, because he certainly is holding some of that stuff tight to the vest related to some investigations that are going on. But we have to have a provision related to people, that old saying, speaking truth to power, right? We have to have that opportunity, and there has to be that provision. Now, in this particular instance, with Ed and the role he serves as our General Secretary Treasurer, if he truly believed that, this is the way things should have played out. Ed should have gone to Harold, say, I'm going to bring some issues up to the executive board. They aren't going to be comfortable in relations to expenses and the policy, some things that I found out. And basically, in the conversation, that's how it should have gone in a functioning organization. You take it to the board, and then the board then makes the decision. Now, if the board made the decision in light of things that are questionably legal or illegal, and they said, no, we're not gonna address it, then you have an obligation, even as a General Secretary Treasurer, to move forward with those issues, because you are a fiduciary for all of us. We pay per capita to you. You're a fiduciary, and you have to act, particularly when we're putting our organization in potential legal jeopardy. And you have to, you just have to do what you have to do. And I think that's the box that Ed found himself in. They didn't have those initial discussions, but that speaks to the dysfunction. But there has to have an ability. And out here in Washington State, over the years, I've audited many locals, some for financial malfeasance, some for just because officers changed place, and our smaller locals, it's almost like tag, you're it. And many of those that are watching know that that's the case. And we're our own greatest enemies in a way, and the fact that we aren't following through with our processes. You know, we have trustees. Sometimes when we get into these issues related to financial malfeasance or perceived financial malfeasance, we have our own policies within our locals, but we don't follow them. We get lazy. We don't have the time. We just put this trust in each other. And I think we could all do better. But I guess to sum it up, I'm kind of rambling on here, Frank. But I would say, yeah, I think there has to be a provision and opportunity for people to bring information forward. But they have to have the evidence as well. If we're using the courts or the legal system as a basis for the baseline of where we're going, certainly you've got to have the information first. And I think we as individuals should be able to ask anything. Anything we should be able to ask, particularly when it comes to the finances. And I'm one of those people that's always done that.
Greg, the truth fears no question. PJ, we'll kick it to you and then we'll kick it to the boss.
Yep. Greg, and I agree with you. I think as a 25-year member of this international, I was in the same shoes as you are, as I still am. I was pissed off. And I think a lot of that comes from the lack of transparency. And that continues today where, you know, the current president still has not really addressed this with the international as a whole. He may have addressed it with the boards behind closed doors, but as a member, it still looks bad. It still smells bad when he's not trying to get out in front of this information and at least be a little bit more transparent with information to members like ourselves. So I do appreciate your answer and your transparency. And we're also today by Chief Hall. And I also want to remind anybody listening today, use the hashtag FE Talk on Twitter, but we're also live on Facebook. Any questions that you may have for Greg, for Frank, myself, or Chief Hall, feel free to put in the comments on Facebook or using the hashtag FE Talk on Twitter, and we'll get those. Chief, welcome. Glad you could join us today.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here. I apologize for my tardiness. I'm a tad under the weather, so I apologize up front, but I do want to thank you, Greg, for taking the time to come on. I think it's so important that we use these platforms, whether it's ours or others in the fire service, that disseminate information broadly more in the IAFF rather than just relying on our IAFF newsletters and other things that we do. And as a member in good standing, I retired a member in good standing. I was an IAFF member my entire career in the fire service, and I have my letter, retired member in good standing. Even as a chief officer in our organization, we were not covered by my bar collective bargaining unit any longer, but we were allowed to continue to pay into our dues, and I did, as did I believe every member of the Albuquerque Fire Department's executive staff at the time, and we were proud to do so. We were a good union, and we put the local first and the members' health and welfare. A couple of things as an ombudsman, just to correct Frank, Ed Kelly never went to the media. He never went outside the IAFF. That the fact that when you disseminate a document such as he did, which was required by our IAFF bylaws and constitution to the district VPs and everyone else who was associated with that, there's going to be leakage. We've all been on this job forever. Telephone, telegraph, telefireman. That's, you know, we grew up with that old adage, and that hasn't changed. So just a brief correction there. Eddie didn't run out to the media and do a press conference. And full disclosure, Harold is one of my oldest and dearest friends, and Eddie is one of my oldest and dearest friends. And just like Thomas Jefferson said, a man's politics, ideology, or religion is no reason for me not to be his friend. And as such, I think Eddie and Harold, I don't know, I wasn't privy to any private conversations they ever may have had or whatnot about it, but knowing both of them, I would assume there was something, you know, hopefully there was something that was, you know, to Greg's point, that was tried early on. But oftentimes, you know, especially today, we often see the world in black and white when we all know it's so many shades of gray. And to that point, I think that, everything happens for a reason, and there's always a silver lining. I mean, you just have to look for it. And I think Greg did a great job of saying that it's really given us an opportunity, and it's a terrible way for Harold's legacy to end. And I don't think that it's going to be the great tarnish that everyone is, you know, assuming it's going to be. I think that oftentimes
the interpretation of some of these regulations is so nuanced that someone probably interpreted it 20 years or 30 years ago and told Tommy and Harold, yeah, this is fine. You can do this. I don't suspect anyone of any kind of ill intent or bad intent. You know what I mean? Oftentimes we make mistakes, and this hopefully will turn out to be in that regard, just a mistake. And to Greg's point about expenses, I think you said it very well. Oftentimes folks just, you know, and I have an expense report, and sometimes it's the reporting side of it that is somewhat difficult. And oftentimes that gets away from folks. And again, I would not ascribe bad intent or malfeasance to any of these men who've and women who've worked so hard for the union and taken care of one another. And to you, Greg, thank you so much for doing this. So I know there's a number of resolutions coming forward, and one of them has to do with PFOAs and PFOSs and gear. And right now, to be honest, it's a rather cloudy issue. We're not sure how dangerous it really is, but we know that those chemicals are dangerous. So we're in kind of a gray area, whether, you know, and the research is ongoing, but we do know that they're in our gear. And we know there's ways that we could mitigate it, either, you know, lockers to hold the gear or containers to hold the gear, and then only wear the gear when necessary, which I think are prudent things to do with the knowledge that we have right now as we look for alternatives to these substances, which are, we have to keep in mind that these substances were put into our gear to protect us from other substances, which are equally as dangerous and perhaps even more lethal. Bloodborne pathogens, chemicals, these PFOAs are a barrier to those substances getting onto our person, which is the problem. So I know there's several resolutions coming forward, Greg, and I just want to know if you're following that issue much, or if you're aware of it, and what your general sense of it is at this point. And I know it's kind of a tough question because it's...
Thank you for that. So we've been a leader out in Washington State as far as legislation related to PFAS and chemicals. In fact, 2 years ago, we got PFAS and foam basically outlawed here in Washington State. And then our latest legislation, although we didn't get what we were after, and basically what it says, if that is used, if these chemicals are used in the construction of bunker gear or in the materials for our bunker gear, our department has to be notified. That's the best we could get in this law, right? And I look at it from this perspective. I think, can you imagine two young guys that or gals that graduated college, one went to work for a chemical company and the other one went to be a firefighter. And, you know, their first job was to, hey, we need to create this chemical to help protect this firefighting gear so it doesn't combust when these people go into fire. So they did their best and they created it. And then we find out later, right? So then I've been wearing it my whole career. This guy's moved up through the ranks of Dow Chemical or wherever he's at. And they find out that there's a potential carcinogens there or potentials for some type of contamination to fires. I really believe that isn't their intent, right? They want to have a product that's completely 100% safe. And I don't think, remember the manufacturers of our bunker gear, they're not making the material. They buy that from somebody else, right? And it's basically immersed or somehow coated in different kinds of chemicals to help with the combustion issue. And I think we have to continue to work with them. Hey, let's face it, we need bunker gear. It's not going away. And I think we have to take a systematic, educated look at all of the things that are out there, follow the science related to it, follow the data, and not overreact, but certainly it's going to take some time to get there. And I think we all have a common theme in mind, and that's the safety of firefighters. And I really believe that our bunker manufacturers are in no way are out there to try to harm us. And they'll work as hard as they can to make sure that those changes are made in the future. So I really see it as just this ongoing issue. It's this kind of generational issue, if you want to talk about it in the sense of generation, where bunker fear has come. The other advancements probably have outweighed the contamination issue. We don't know that for sure, and there's much more to come.
It's the great law of unintended consequences, right? We, you know, Seneca once said it best. He said, our descendants will be amazed at the things that are so obvious to them that we currently are unaware of. Because life and science just continues to reveal itself as time goes on. And to your point, exactly right. And but what I think has become the great, oddity of our time is ascribing motive to people as if, you know, that young gal that graduated from college and became a chemical engineer, you know, had malintent. Oh, I'm going to put this really bad stuff in there. Nothing could be further from the truth. And the truth be known, many of the folks that manufacture our gear wear our gear. I mean, they're around it more than we are, for goodness sakes, as they're in the manufacturing process. But clearly, many of them are firefighters. So thank you. That was a great answer. And I think that we need to, as a union, look at some reasonable and smart things that we can do to minimize exposure while we investigate this issue and as we move forward with less toxic deals. My second question comes to you on a kind of a political nature, and full disclosure, I'm a patriot, unapologetically Catholic, just like Harold, unapologetically Catholic, unapologetically patriotic, and unapologetically a constitutionalist. And although I'm right-leaning, I do have, you know, Ron Reagan behind me and good old Abe Lincoln, two famous Republicans. But on the other wall, unfortunately, you can't see it, I've got Bobby Kennedy and my dad, who are two of my favorite Democrats. So I'm politically a mixed bag, but much more right-leaning than most. I'm not into the progressive movement. I admire true liberal Democrats, but I'm not into the progressive movement, just up front. So I was wondering what your thoughts are on, and I know there's several resolutions about having a union-wide vote in regards to presidential elections and endorsements, which I favor, or I would actually favor something more nuanced where locals or maybe states, you know, state IFF groups could choose state by state or local by local how they wanted to endorse. But that's more nuanced, and that's not one of the resolutions. The resolutions currently are for nationwide vote before we do nationwide nominations. But my question to you is a little more nuanced, and the union, in many ways, to those of us that are on the conservative side of the aisle, sometimes doesn't feel as welcoming. And I was wondering if with you and Eddie and others who are younger and more, I think, more politically open. The candidates are less restricted ideologically than they were back in the day. In other words, there are many Republicans who are very pro-labor and very pro-union, and there are many, you know, Democrats who are not. And so it's a much different bag than it was in say the 30s and 40s and 50s, but we still seem to be locked into a very monolithic political structure, in my view, as a more conservative leaning member. But I'm right up front. I'm pro Second Amendment, pro free speech. I think the Bill of Rights is pretty much sacrosanct as far as I'm concerned. I don't think it's evolving with time. I think it was, I'm an originalist, and I think that it needs to be defended as an oath keeper. And as firefighters, we are oath keepers. We swore to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States, not as we interpret it as it's written. I mean, it didn't say as you feel about it. So I'm just wondering what you would do as our new, you know, General Secretary to kind of make the union more welcoming and more open and less. I was actually told by a friend who was running for a position that he was worried about my endorsement because someone told him, well, you got to be careful because we don't want any right-leaning influence to get in here. And I laugh while I'm saying this because I'm looking at Frank Ritchie, who is a very conservative gentleman, internationally known conservative gentleman, who was one of the best union presidents in recent memory. And I think that's inarguable. But so what do you think we can do to have more voices heard? And I wrote an editorial probably 8 years ago that was Democrats at work and Republicans at home. And I received probably 50,000, 60,000 follow-ups to it saying, yep. And it doesn't mean that we, I think we're all, we all support the union and collective bargaining, but we have, you know, we have our views and we'd like to be able to express them and get support.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for that question. So
that's a, full, there's a loaded gun for you.
Yeah. Full disclosure. Okay. I lean left. I walk way out there in the radical left, but I lean left. In fact, I ran for the state legislature here in Washington State this way back in 2003. And really, when I say I lean left, because I really believe in the rights of working people, right? If that's fundamental, that's a big basket of ideas and thoughts. You know, it's interesting that you bring that up. And if we're going to center around, we could start by centering around this endorsement by our international for the president. And let's roll back 4 years. And when Clinton, you had the Clinton-Trump race, and we stayed out of that. And I didn't like the fact that we stayed out of it, but we did, all right? We have to make those decisions. And it's my understanding that the international polled our membership. We actually got a polling company. We did a poll that had a meaningful results within the margin of error. And it was, and there was a lot of pushback from some of our southern states and other areas that said, hey, yeah, because of Clinton in this instance, and it wasn't, you could say R&D, but I think it was a combination of Clinton herself and the baggage that she brought, and the fact that they were going to lose a lot of membership if the IFF went that way. So our board made a decision for staying out. Although Clinton was a huge friend, as you, if you think of labor, certainly, and the IFF, as was her husband, and we made the decision, and it was what it was. And then fast forward to this endorsement, you know, our executive board has to make the decision they have to make what they think is best for all of us. You know, we had supported Biden for the last 40 years and the things that he'd done. Biden had come to our conventions and our Redmond's, or when we were in DC, when he was the vice president, he'd show up and speak. And although it seemed like a no-brainer, I don't know for sure. Did we do a poll again? I don't know. And I think we probably should do it. That's a starter, right? I think that's the information where we start with a poll, a real poll of our members. And we know in the IFF, basically not far different from the United States, 44% of our members lean right, 44% lean left. And we're really after the middle. That's what we're, all of these races are. And they're going to be that way for the next 50 years now. And we have to make sure that everyone has a voice. You know, when I think about out here in Washington State, then, you know, coming back from the international now to the state organizations, you know, I think every state organization, just like every local, has local autonomy. And that's always going to continue to be the way it is. And certainly when people break away and don't go with the mainstream ideas, they may take some heat for it, rightfully so. I guess that's what part of democracy is here. But our state association, in this case, we followed the IFF's lead, but I think we would have gone there anyhow. In Washington State, a more liberal state, right? We get more things done for firefighters and working families with Democrats in office than we have with Republicans. And we've been a long time Democratic, very strong Democratic state anyhow. And maybe not fair in that comparison, but I've worked in politics out here in Washington State for 30 years. And we've made some substantial advancements in presumptive legislation and other legislation for the health and safety of firefighters. And that's come about with Republicans and Democrats voting for it. And, you know, I think that's the importance that we seem to lose sometimes, is the value of creating relationships and actually having discussions and respecting someone else's opinion. Now, we know some people, both on the right and left, they're way out there. And you're just like, oh, my God, you know, you just get racked your head like, come on. But in general, I think our members are the ones that I've talked to in Washington State, we've always respected differences of opinions. And very rarely, you know, every once in a while, somebody will go out on these fringes. But I think that's where we have to start, is this kind of commonality and respect for everyone's opinion, although it's not our own. And you know, I don't think there's this necessarily group think about we're always going to be Democrat. We, our IFS supports plenty of Republicans at the national level. And it's just that some of the things that we've seen and the accomplishments we've seen, even when we're in a Republican-controlled Congress, we've gotten legislation through because we see the value of the relationships with being on both sides of the aisle. So I know that's not really a succinct answer, and I don't know if there is one, but I think it starts with respecting each other's opinions and having the willingness to not be afraid to ask what their opinions are.
That's excellent. Thank you. So my final question to you, and then I'll turn it back over to the hosts, but I have to echo what Frank said. You don't dodge, which is great, which is really great. And I'm happy to hear that. So I'm retired, IFF, member in good standing. And as a retired firefighter, I have been advocating for the reevaluation of WEP, and which is the windfall elimination provision, and its accompanying legislation that penalizes my widow, because I always worked two gigs, had to, you know, my wife didn't work. So I always worked two gigs, and I have paid into Social Security. And since my post-retirement, I have paid in, and yet my Social Security is going to be dramatically affected. Now that legislation was enacted and the IAFF opposed it when it was enacted 40 years ago. And it was aimed at federal workers. And it was at a time when record keeping was much different than it is today. It was paper and pencil, it was typewriters, it was letters. And the federal workers who paid zero in and were receiving health and all the rest of it were targeted for that and their ability to double dip later. So that was the nuance that brought that about. And then that legislation was passed. Railroad workers who had a very strong union at the time were exempted. Only railroad workers, their union got them exempted. So now here we are, fast forward, we've had legislation from a Democratic congressperson in Ohio, his name escapes me for a moment, very famous, great guy too, but very, very liberal Democrat, who has been trying for probably the last 8 or 10 years to get in there and at least modernize that legislation. So it's not just some blanket. Because as you know, Greg, pensions differ, sometimes neighborhood to neighborhood. And some people paid in quite a bit of money and they get, you know, 50%. And some people pay in virtually nothing and they get 100% and medical. So it's all over the place in terms of pension. And that has to do with, you know, the collective bargaining locally. Yet we're all lumped together as if we were all federal workers under WEP. And the windfall elimination provision of firefighters listening is no. It. When you retire, don't count on any Social Security whatsoever because they're going to slam you because you were a firefighter and you've got a government pension. So I have petitioned the union repeatedly. And as a retired firefighter, it's as if, you know, our years of loyalty and commitment isn't being heard. That needs to be addressed as more and more firefighters, like me, are living longer. That small amount of money you get from Social Security makes a huge difference, especially if your pension isn't from one of the, you know, more robust pension systems. Or like in my case has been reduced and affected negatively, yet nothing's been done on that issue. So what I'm asking for you is, would you be willing to make a commitment to look into it and to help retired IAFF members, you know, to get at least their fair share? And I'm not asking for anything to be done, you know, I just want to be treated like every other American and not like some special class because I have a pension. And you know, one of the things that pensioners learn very quickly is you can outlive your pension. And especially like, I don't have any medical. So if you have medical expenses and things like that, you can outlive it pretty damn quick. And so, you know, I'm on a board of a group of people who, matter of fact, we're meeting in a few moments where we have a retired firefighter's home. and we have men, all men right now, but we'll probably have women soon, who are basically destitute. They're basically destitute, and they have pensions, but those pensions, into their 80s and 90s, are not what they were 30, 40 years ago. And they don't, and I think to a man, none of them are getting basically anything from Social Security, although many of them paid in. But you have to hit the maximum amount per year in order to get any credit for that year. So some of them came within $100 or $500, and every year it went up. So now I think it's at a level of like, I believe it's like at $50,000-$60,000 of taxable, which is a great deal of money if you're, a blue collar worker. And most of the men and women like me were former mechanic. I was a mechanic, or you're a former mechanic, or you worked in the restaurant industry, your brother's restaurant, or you did roofing, that kind of things and such. So I was wondering if you'd be interested or willing to at least commit to looking into it and trying to help us. And it's, gosh, I wish I could remember the congressman's name from Ohio. I apologize.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember it. So, well, first of all, 100%, I'm all in. So you're talking about the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset. One of them affects us. The other one affects our widows. Widowers, correct. That term you're used, you have to meet this substantial earnings threshold each year. And way back, you go back in the 70s, it was like $4,000. But yeah, it has ratcheted up over the years. I'm not sure what it is right now. It may be up near that $50,000 level now. Yeah, and it seems ridiculous to me. So we are looking at this on some fronts. I can remember a couple of years ago, going back to the IFF Legislative Conference, and we addressed this issue with our Congress members related to WEP and GPO and the elimination of that. On another front, I don't know if you've heard of the National Conference on Public Employee Retirement Systems, called NCPERS. Mm-hmm. That's another issue that they're down there lobbying for on our behalf. And I've been involved with that organization, at least attending their meetings for the last 15 or 20 years, when we go visit our congressmen and women, and actively trying to really eliminate that that provision there that takes your Social Security. Like you said, you may think you're getting $1,500 a month and you end up getting $300 a month. And I've always disagreed it. And like you, I've always had a second job. I go on to the Social Security website every once in a while. I look, okay, let me figure out how many more years. So if you go up to 30 years of substantial earnings, there's no offset. And then from there, it ratchets down on your substantial earnings years and the amount of reduction that you would see. So I'm 100% in. I'm 100% in for all of our retirees. There's another provision, and I don't want to stretch this out. So the IFF actually created a relationship with Aetna to create a Med Advantage plan. So all our retired members who are 65 years and older, you have to buy, you get Part A, Part B, but you've got to get a Med Advantage plan, a supplemental plan to fill in all the holes that Medicare has. And we've created a great plan that will provide benefits to our members. I created a Med Advantage plan in our Northwest Firefighter Trust as well, found that that plan was a little better than what the IFF had created. And if you get an opportunity, and I'm trying to marry those two plans together now to provide the very best, and they're very reasonable cost plans. You know, that's a very competitive market, right? Humana, you see Joe Namath on TV all the time selling these Med Advantage plans. So I think there are some other opportunities, but they're now, the IFF through the Financial Corps has created this opportunity through Aetna to get onto that plan, and certainly looking to expand that nationally.
If you would take one other issue to them, and just so you know, and as you know, I've got the Founders Award for the Firefighter Cancer Support Network for my good friend, Mike DeBron. I've always been very active in the cancer issue for the last 30 years since my initial diagnosis. As I turned 65, what I found to be very interesting is that you have to redo all your life insurance. You're uninsurable if you have cancer, active cancer. So I have no life insurance. And if we're going to have presumptive laws, that's great. But we ought to have some kind of lobbying to say, look, if you're covered by a presumptive law and you're a firefighter and you develop a cancer, We ought to work with one of those companies to say, look, we'll at least get you some kind of life insurance so that when you do pass, you know, your beneficiaries get something, even if it's just, you know, the bare minimum, you know, $50,000-$60,000 to get them past the funeral and such. But when you go to re-up at 65, no, there's not a company in America that will insure you.
I'm not surprised.
Right.
I actually have an insurance license out here in Washington State. Not that I sell insurance, but I did it to kind of create a program for our guys so they could best marry insurance with their spousal choice when they had to retire, right? Because you take a hit at the pension piece. But I hadn't thought about that. I'd have to think about that more on what kind of solutions we could create to help our retirees. You know, I'm all for all of our members who put in our long careers and basically put our lives on the line. And I'm not going to try to dramatize this by any means, because we just loved it. We do it every day. We'd go back and do it, you know, when we're 70, if we
could. I'm still doing it. There's your example.
I think we have to look at things like that. I really hadn't even thought about that issue, but I'd be glad to look at that as well.
Well, because there's more and more guys like me and gals like me, you know, cancer is a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
And I can say that definitively at this very moment. Yeah. So we would appreciate it, because I didn't see it coming, and I turned 65. Oh, you got to do all your insurance. Couldn't find a company in America. And my insurance guy told me, you're not going to find one. No one's going to insure you while you're battling cancer.
Right.
And there's tens of thousands of us, I'm sure.
Right. Yeah, I'd be glad to look.
Just a couple real quick questions, and we really appreciate your time, and you stayed on for a real long time. I know you only gave us a half hour, and you're here, so you know it's kind of like a fire. So we appreciate you. We talked a lot about cancer, and we talked about forever chemicals. A lot of members out there are concerned with whether you're on the right or the left. The one thing that brings firefighters together is the fact that health and safety, and advocating for firefighter health and safety, is something we all agree on, that especially in some of our jurisdictions where it's one party town, one way or the other, the union's the only voice really advocating for firefighters' health and safety. And I think that's a critical and important role. What's your take on, and I'm not saying there was impropriety, but there's the appearance of impropriety when we have the gear companies and the chemical companies giving direct sponsorships to the IFF on cancer summits. Here. And again, I'm not
surrounded more than we are, for goodness sakes.
I couldn't hear him, but what do you call it? You know, I'm all for capitalism, but do you feel that is something that needs to be looked at, or where are you at on that one?
Yeah, we cut out there. What groups are giving money for these cancer summits?
You're looking at per the LM2s, you have a lot of the gear companies and chemical companies when the summit is actually supposed to be kind of the watchdog, even though they may not be doing anything wrong intentionally. A lot of members, there's been back and forth. Is it just the inference of impropriety?
Yeah, I think, you know, this has come up in a couple other interviews the last couple months. And, you know, I guess it's a mixed bag. It's not a simple answer here. I really believe those individuals and those companies want to stop. We all want to stop cancer. Everybody wants to stop cancer for everyone. And, you know, and I don't think that they believe they're contributing to it. Although now we're finding out in retrospect that they are, and, you know, are they doing it on purpose? I don't believe so. They're doing it. This isn't back to when smoking nicotine and cigarettes, right? And, you know, these corporations back in the 50s and 60s hit all the information about that causing cancer. I don't think we've seen any definitive studies that have been hidden. They've been hiding something. It's interesting. I mentioned the National Conference on Public Employee Retirement Systems. They have a code of conduct, and that code of conduct, it was up to 10-point code of conduct. And that really spoke to basically investment firms that we use as public pensions and their willingness to sign this code of conduct. And it had things in there about not doing things to her in public pensions, not fighting against defined benefit pensions, those types of things. I think we could create a code of conduct that basically said, if you want to be a vendor for the international, you have to sign, be willing to sign this code of conduct, or we don't want your money. And some of those things are, you are selling equipment to our members that in some way could harm them. And, you know, and let's say, well, we've got this issue going on with, you know, this chemicals in the gear. Well, then we need a disclaimer related to all of that stuff and why that happens. So we can have a clear explanation and there's transparency related. Okay, what are you doing about it? Rather than, well, it is what it is. We're waiting for them to outlaw it and then we'll figure out something else. And you know, these chemical companies, they're looking at other alternatives, but we may find in retrospect, the other alternatives they come up with do the same thing, but we don't find that out for 20 years. So I think it's a very tough question. I think if we could have our vendors sign this code of conduct, and more than anything, they were looking out for our best interest as defined in this code of conduct, I'm okay with accepting money from vendors. It's you know, it helps really tamper down our per capita or our registration fees for our events. So I don't know if that answers it, Frank, but
Greg, again, I got to say, I appreciate that honesty and I support your view. I think that it's a slippery slope when you start to decide, you know, who can participate and who can't participate. And I understand the concern on the people who say you've got the very people who are producing these materials who may be responsible for it in some indirect way or direct way. And then you're taking their money. Is that going to influence, you know, the summit's findings and things? That's a very crooked path, if you will. In other words, there's not a direct line from taking money to influencing a decision. Although, I'm leaning towards Greg's solution. I think that's a good solution, and I think, and I almost think it's superfluous because I think that anyone who's in this industry, I have never met. First of all, I've never met a firefighter I didn't like. And then I've never met anybody in the industry I didn't like. And because I agree with Greg, the folks developing our gear and our equipment are second to none. And I think this is just to go back to our earlier conversation, the law of unintended consequences. And, you know, we may find out someday that wearing a suit makes you stupid. And we'll have to tell all you union guys to quit wearing those cheap suits. Just kidding. I always laugh. Because you guys don't look like it's your first Holy Communion suit. The things are all like 30 years old. They're out of style for like 20 years. They're just so hysterical. I used to call it the Union Thug suit. Here comes the Union Thugs. And I was one, so I can say that.
PJ, we're at the witching hour. I'm going to give you the last question.
Close us out, PJ.
We're going to let Greg give his, you know, his elevator pitch if he met a in a bar or a coffee shop. Right. And they said, hey, why should we vote for you? But let's just go for PJ. Any last comments for Greg? He's been very gracious and he stayed on. So we really do appreciate it.
Yeah, and I actually have to bail. So I'm going to make a quick comment going back a little bit, then I have to bail early. So I apologize for that. But Greg, first, thanks for coming on and being very upfront and open and honest with us. We really appreciate the dialogue. I just want to go back a little bit because I am one of those members who disagreed with the endorsement, this past endorsement of Joe Biden. But I also do completely agree with your statement of respecting others' difference of opinions. And I feel, and the members that I've spoke to feel that their voice is not being heard. And you also said something else that I think was key. You said a real poll of all IFF members would really go far for the membership. If this endorsement went through as it did, and my voice was, or my opinion was polled, I would fully support the IFF stance because it was what the majority of the international members wanted. Not a board, not executive board, not based on some decisions that were made behind closed doors. So moving forward, if you're elected, I know I would appreciate, as well as many other members, well, as you said, a real poll of all members for large issues like this that impact us all. And I think regardless of the outcome, you would find that the majority of members would support that decision if it was the majority making that decision. So again, I really appreciate your honesty and you joining us today. I apologize that I have to bail early. There's somebody else looking to get in here to fix the heat before we get too cold over the next couple of days. We break some water pipes. But Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to everybody. I look forward to a great 2021. I hope it's going to be better than what we've been experiencing. So I look forward to everybody, and I thank everybody for following today. So Frank, Chief Walton, it's back to you, and Greg, thanks again.
Merry Christmas, all right, yeah, PJ.
Thanks, PJ. Greg, yeah.
All right. So one, what PJ just said there, you know, we can do all the polls we want, but there's got to be trust, right? There has to be fundamentally, there has to be trust in our organization. And I think now more than ever at the IFF level, whether it's financial issues or issues related to this election, I think the trust level's down. We have to bring the trust level. We have to figure out a way that our members, regardless of their political ideology, has a trust in their leadership. And, you know, I think just fundamentally, from my perspective, you've heard my comments today, you know, I'll make compromises when it comes to ideas and programs on the betterment of the international and the benefits of our members. But one thing I'll never compromise is my personal integrity or my integrity on behalf of the IFF. And that's a commitment that I'd make to all of you. And I think that that's what you'd expect of your elected principal officers. So I just thank you for the opportunity today. Certainly, I wish everybody a happy holidays. If you need more information on my campaign, it's Markley for the number 4 GST.org. And appreciate everybody's support and ask for your vote as well. So thank you.
Thanks, Greg. We'll have Peter put up the direct link to your campaign site as well as soon as we get off here. And Bobby, do you have any last words? And thank you for coming on today. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah. And again, I apologize for being late, Greg. I feel terrible that life got in the way, unfortunately. I wanted to say thank you to Greg, and it's a pleasure to meet you. I think we've bumped into each other once or twice before, but just to hear you speak, obviously, I think your integrity comes through. I think that you're very well spoken, and I think that and you're very honest, and I absolutely appreciate that. And I think that what's so demonstrative is that I'm pretty right, you're pretty left, and we still love and respect one another. Alan Bernasini and I were best friends. He was very left, I'm very right. We love and respect one another because we have a mutual mission, and that's the American Fire Service, period, for me. You know, and I get it, you're international, but for me, it's just the American Fire Service. God bless the Canadians. I can't do anything to help them. So, well, I can, but I mean, I'm focused on the American Fire Service, and I always will be. Because there's nothing I love more than God and my country and my family. So, and I think all those things are intertwined in the American Fire Service. And I think that's, and you, all your answers reflected that same kind of commitment and honesty and integrity. So I really do want to wish you all the best and what a pleasure coming on. And I will give you this one commitment, irrespective of who wins in these elections, Fire Engineering, Firefighter Nation, Journal of Medical Services, all of the publications that I'm affiliated with through the Clarion are at your disposal. If the international needs to get a message out or wants to do a presentation or has a message, we're here for you. And we have good reach and we won't censor it or edit it or anything like that. We'll give you, and Tim Burns knows that. We publish everything Tim gives us. We get it up as quick as we can. But we want to strengthen that relationship and hopefully we can. You know, we provided the main program stage to Harold for years, and he accessed it. And, you know, FDIC is the international has always been welcome there and will always continue to be, and, you know, free booths and such. And we'd love it if you want to, you know, do more. And so, you know, as you move through the system, you know, and if you're successful, we hope that you keep that in the back of your mind, that our platform is your platform. Our membership is your membership. And we're all working towards the same, whether your career, a volunteer or brigade or federal or local or state or county, whatever, wildland, we're all in this together. You know, we've all got a stick on the ice. And I think that the more that we remember, we've got more in common than we do in our small nuanced differences. You know, you say potato, I say potato. We're all in this together. And in the end, that's the most important thing. And I think you did a wonderful job of representing not only yourself, but, you know, the great state of Washington. And it is a great state. Little too left for me, but I'm just kidding.
Yeah, and I think this is the point, you know, where we'd clink glasses. I'd say exactly here to exactly everything.
Exactly. You can keep Portland. I'll keep Tulsa.
Okay. Well, that's Oregon.
About politics, it's about.
And to everybody else out there, God bless you. Merry Christmas. I hope it's a beautiful holiday. I hope that whatever holiday you celebrate now is wonderful. But to my Christian friends, God bless you. Merry Christmas. And to everyone out there, you know, thank you for supporting us and participating. And please take care of one another and just take care of one another.
That's the one thing we can all agree on. Everybody be safe out there. Take care of each other. Greg, thank you so much for coming on. The truth fears no question. And you answered every question today, honestly, with integrity. I appreciate that. You did a great job. And we look forward to seeing you in the future. Everybody have a great holiday.
All right. Take care. Thank you. We'll be right back.